The associates of the powerful Ampatuan family were responsible for the 2009 attack on journalists and the family members of their political rivals. Today, an Ampatuan housekeeper testified that she heard family members plotting the attack less than a week before it happened. According to Reporters Without Borders, more journalists lost their lives in the Southern Philippines massacre than on any other day in history. The trial is being seen as a test of the independence of the country's new government. Nearly 200 people are currently accused of involvement in the incident. And that's headlines for Free Speech Radio News. From Eugene, Oregon, I'm Jess Burns.
This is Dorian Marina in New York. President Obama unveiled new ideas today to stimulate the economy and help lagging unemployment. His middle-of-the-road approach includes Republican and conservative strategies to reduce taxes. But in this campaign season, the Congress members responsible for passing a plan are talking past each other and disagreeing on ideas they once endorsed. FSRN's Leanne Caldwell reports.
At a community college near Cleveland, Ohio, President Obama described the difference between Democratic and Republican economic plans. Shrouded in campaign politics, the president highlighted his new economic proposals in the same town where, just 2 weeks ago, the Republican leader of the House of Representatives unveiled his own economic plan.
Do we return to the same failed policies that ran our economy into a ditch, or do we keep moving forward with policies that are slowly pulling us out?
The irony is that the president's economic proposals are not much different from Republican ideas. But because Republicans are objecting to any idea offered by a person with a Democrat next to his name, consensus is unlikely. Obama proposes a permanent tax credit for business research and development. He also proposes that businesses write off all capital improvements through 2011. Economist Heather Boucher with the liberal-leaning Center for American Progress dislikes the idea. She says the tax cuts do little to spur the economy.
With borrowing rates already so low, it's really not the main concern. What you see in survey after survey of small businesses is that they simply don't have enough customers to justify investments right now. So it all comes back to demand.
But Obama has embraced the business tax cuts that Republicans have promoted in the past. Obama's third proposal is an additional $50 billion in funding for investment on roads and infrastructure. It's a similar idea implemented by the Tennessee governor and was promoted by Republican ally, the U.S. Chamber of Commerce, as recently as July. Wednesday morning, Republican John Boehner was interviewed by George Stephanopoulos on Good Morning America. He offered a hint of willingness to work together.
George, I'm open to the president's ideas.
But the tone quickly changed. Instead of talking about the president's Republican-friendly proposals, Boehner focused on issues that have no chance of going anywhere. Boehner called it his two-point plan, freezing government spending and extending the Bush-era tax cuts.
Why don't we pass a bill this month at 2008 spending levels, you know, before the TARP, before the bailouts, before the stimulus, and let's put some certainty in the economy. That in and of itself would save about $100 billion this year alone. And then secondly, why wouldn't we work together to make it clear that all current tax rates will be extended for the next 2 years?
In this election season, ideas that might once have been agreed upon have a slim chance of moving forward. Instead, the economic focus this fall will likely be around the Bush-era tax cuts. As Boehner said, Republicans want them extended for at least 2 years. President Obama and most Democrats say they need to be repealed on all couples making more than $250,000 per year.
Now, for any income over this amount, the tax rates would just go back to what they were under President Clinton. This isn't to punish folks who are better off. God bless them. It's because we can't afford the $700 billion price tag.
For at least the next 9 weeks until Election Day, Republicans will likely talk about curtailing spending as a means to spur the economy. while Democrats are expected to discuss investment and incentive. Two ideologies that in this political climate will see little common ground, even if they aren't that many worlds apart. Leanne Caldwell, FSRN, Washington, D.C.
Secretary of State Hillary Clinton addressed members of the Council on Foreign Relations on Wednesday. In her remarks, Clinton outlined the Obama administration's broad foreign policy strategies and took questions from members on a range of topics. As Michael Lawson reports, the 21st century foreign policy agenda also includes domestic issues.
In her remarks, Clinton discussed the administration's intention to build what they call a new global architecture for the country to lead in the 21st century. Clinton used the president's national security strategy to outline how to achieve overall foreign policy goals.
Today more than ever, our ability to exercise global leadership depends on building a strong foundation here at home. That's why rising debt and crumbling infrastructure pose very real long-term national security threats.
The administration's strategy hinges on strengthening infrastructure and economic security, a break from the unilateral military focus of most of the Bush presidency. Paul Kavika Martin is organizing director for grassroots coalition Peace Action. He says while the shift in focus is a start, there is a long way to go before foreign policy represents American values.
The Obama administration has certainly used better rhetoric throughout the world, less Islam bashing, etc. Also good. But on the other side, we have tripled the number of troops in Afghanistan. We haven't closed Guantanamo. We've said good things about nuclear weapons, that we're increasing the amount of money we're spending on nuclear weapons by 20%.
While peace groups think the Pentagon could make more budget cuts, especially for weapons, Clinton lamented congressional cuts to State Department agencies she says are responsible for ensuring success in Iraq. Clinton said the country needs a more sensible approach integrating diplomatic and military funding needs.
It's a mistake to look at all of these items, foreign aid, diplomatic, operations, defense, as stovepipes, because what we know, especially from the threats that we have faced in Iraq and now in Afghanistan, is you have to be more integrated. So let's start thinking from a budget perspective about how to be more integrated.
Besides changing domestic spending priorities, Clinton says diplomacy in the 21st century must acknowledge changing global realities. She discussed the U.S. role in Sudan, saying the country's referendum vote in 2011 to separate into North and South could be a ticking time bomb. The decision could have an impact on oil and other natural resources in the country. Amira Woods is with Foreign Policy in Focus.
Well, clearly when we talk about Sudan, we have to talk about oil. When we talk about Africa, we have to talk about oil. Now Africa has surpassed the Middle East as a supplier of oil to the United States. That has changed the calculus in terms of U.S. engagement with the continent.
Closer to home, Clinton expressed growing concern about Mexican drug cartel violence, but acknowledged stopping the flow of U.S. weapons to Mexico would be a major part of ending the bloodshed. Michael Lawson, FSRN, Washington.
UN Secretary General Ban Ki-moon met with Rwandan President Paul Kagame today and urged the leader not to withdraw troops from a peacekeeping mission in Sudan. Kagame threatened to pull troops out of Sudan after a draft UN report on the aftermath of the Rwandan genocide was leaked. The report finds that Rwandan troops and Congolese rebels pursued Hutus following the 1994 Rwandan genocide and killed tens of thousands of people. According to the BBC, the draft report calls the acts damning and that, if proven by court, could be classified as genocide. Rwandan officials denied the charges and called the report's findings malicious. Rwanda has 3,500 troops in Sudan, which are seen as key to security ahead of a referendum on independence set for January. The UN has delayed publication of the controversial report until October 1st. In other news from the region, the head of the UN Department of Political Affairs, Atul Kare, returned from an investigative trip to the Democratic Republic of the Congo, saying an estimated 500 people, mostly women and young girls, had been raped in the North Kivu and South Kivu provinces in July and August. Since news of the incident surfaced, the number of cases has steadily risen. On Tuesday, Kare told the Security Council that the UN mission in DR Congo had failed and that quick action should be taken.
It is essential that the perpetrators of this heinous crime are swiftly apprehended and brought to justice. rapid and exemplary punishment would deter others who might repeat similar criminal acts.
News of the attacks began to emerge from an aid group in the region treating survivors, but the scale of the rapes did not come out until later. The UN released an internal email indicating UN agencies knew that rebels were in the area and that one rape had occurred, but UN workers did not reach the area until August. Margot Wallström, the top UN official dealing with sexual violence and conflict, said that the incidents are part of a disturbing trend.
It is evident that rape is increasingly selected as the weapon of choice in Eastern DRC, with numbers reaching endemic proportions. And the sad reality is that incidents of rape has become so commonplace that they do not trigger our most urgent interventions.
Wallström added that she is planning a trip to the DR Congo next month to listen to survivors and to address the issue in person. Today, BP released findings from its four-month internal investigation into the cause of the April explosion in the Gulf of Mexico that killed 11 workers and led to the worst oil disaster in U.S. history. The 193-page report posted on the company's website finds failings in the work performed on the well leading up to the disaster. It says BP engineers and Transocean rig workers misinterpreted pressure tests and that the blow-up preventer, designed to avert such an accident, failed to operate correctly. BP declined FSRN's request for an interview. To find out more, we're joined by Kieran Suckling, the executive director of the Center for Biological Diversity, an environmental advocacy group that has been critical of the BP response to the disaster. Welcome to FSRN.
Thanks for having me on.
There are what BP calls eight key findings from this report that are causes of the accident. BP engineers are mentioned to be responsible in part of one of those, specifically with pressure tests. But it also spreads the blame to Transocean workers. It also mentions Halliburton, which was responsible for the cement, which is identified as a problem. But overall in this report, what's new here?
There really isn't anything new. We've had months and months of congressional hearings, so I don't see anything new here in terms of a new cause. I think it's mostly of repackaging what BP has already said, and I think the main thing BP is doing in this report today is trying to control its legal liability by saying other players are to blame, and secondly, to make all the errors that happen appear to be non-criminal errors, because if it turns out that the government decides that there was criminal negligence, the billions will quickly start to ratchet up in terms of the fines that BP will suffer.
Well, today, a report in Forbes magazine points out that BP has made what it calls a vitally important distinction by saying that BP's well design is not at fault. Forbes said that that could be a difference in $20 billion in government fines and other costs. The report also notes that BP shares were up 3% this morning. As you mentioned, this report comes out during the process of government hearings. There's also a government investigation that's still not finished. Is there a reason why we are getting the findings, the release of this report now?
Yeah, I think several things are going on. One, BP is very cognizant that its stock values have been plummeting, and it's trying to maintain that stock value at the same time that it brings in a new director. Secondly, BP is aware that the government is starting to hone in with its own conclusions as to what happened, and so BP wants to get out in front of that and to start to control the messaging. And I think this well design issue is one that we're going to come back to again and again. I do think that was an important conclusion of this report.
There's also a larger issue here, and it's one that your organization has been on top of, and that's the process that through which BP got the lease on the rig, that BP was able to lease the rig without environmental review, without a thorough review of safety. Is that covered in this report?
No, not at all. This report paints the failure in the most narrow technical way possible, so that the response to preventing it becomes also a very narrow technical question with very little policy implication. So it does not talk about the big picture at all, which I believe is the most crucial cause of this, and that is that at every stage of government oversight, from giving BP the lease to giving them the right to drill at that spot, to approving the engineering designs, to approving them not testing their equipment, at all of these stages, the government exempted BP from all environmental laws, and so there was never a thorough review. There was never an opportunity to challenge their spill response plan. And those were all the stages where safety measures could have been put in place and should have been put in place. Those were all the stages where the spill response could have been made vastly better than it was. And BP wants to stay completely away from that, because once you go there, you're talking about tremendous regulatory reform. It's going to cost the industry a lot of money, and it's going to greatly slow down the amount of oil that will get drilled. So they certainly don't want to even be engaging that arena.
Kieran Suckling is the executive director of the Center for Biological Diversity. Thank you for joining us.
Thanks for having me on. Bye-bye.
In related news, a federal study released Tuesday found that oxygen levels in the ocean near the damaged well had dropped by 20%, but that the levels weren't low enough to create dead zones. The Houston Chronicle reports that the study drew on 419 locations in the Gulf over 3 months. Scientists had warned that the extensive use of underwater dispersants could lead to lower oxygen levels, which could kill fish and other organisms. 4 years ago, a U.S.-based nonprofit set out to expand educational opportunities for poor and low-income children by creating low-power, durable, and internet-connected laptops. The first one-laptop-per-child units were delivered to Uruguay and Birmingham, Alabama. Over the last few years, Massachusetts-based One Laptop Per Child has delivered more than 1 million units. But the new market also caught the attention of computer giants Intel and Microsoft. Now some countries, including Argentina, are contracting with these corporations. FSRN's Marcos Federman reports from Buenos Aires.
Argentina's plan is ambitious. The government aims to put a laptop in the hands of every public high school student. It will distribute more than 200,000 netbooks this year and 3 million by 2012. Argentina's program aims to reduce the digital divide, promote social inclusion, and teach job skills. Some of the first computers were distributed about 30 miles from Buenos Aires in the impoverished town of Maquinista Savio. Eighth grader Emmanuel Moravi said he's excited about the new program.
I think it is going to be a very great use for the whole society. We are now in a period of great technological advancement, and I think that every student will benefit and put these computers to good use.
Many Argentine families can't afford to buy their children computers, but the laptops will become the students' property after they graduate high school. The national government originally planned to buy computers from the U.S.-based nonprofit One Laptop Per Child, or OLPC. Officials had seen positive results in provinces San Luis and La Rioja and in neighboring Uruguay, where OLPC's XO's laptops were distributed amongst primary school students. But after hard lobbying by Intel and Microsoft, government officials chose Intel's classmate over OLPC's XO. Mariana Iribarne is a corporate manager at Intel Argentina, and she says classmate netbooks are superior.
Well, it has it comes with a software which allows the teacher to manage the classroom. It can, for example, share the screen that one student is viewing with the rest of the students, or it can the teacher can also monitor what the students are doing. They can take tests with that software directly managed by the teacher.
But not all agree. Dio Levis was a member of a consulting committee that evaluated OLPCs and Intel's computers. He says the OLPC notebooks have a pedagogical advantage and are designed for environments where low-income people live. For example, OLPC laptops can charge their batteries without an electricity connection, and their screens can be seen during daylight and under the sun for students whose schools are outside. He says not many of his suggestions were taken into account.
I see a very important difference. Classmates uses Windows, and it's seen as an educational tool that reinforces traditional teaching. It means there was no pedagogical innovation in the sense that it will be used in the same way the blackboard or the library is used. On the other hand, OLPC uses open source software, specially designed to be used in the schools with a constructionist point of view. This means that students are actively participating in their own educational process, and not only memorizing the school program.
For a brief 6-month period in 2007, OLPC and Intel worked together, but that partnership ended after what Intel called philosophical disagreements. OLPC's founder, Nicolas Negroponte, did not grant FSRN's interview requests. But in a statement released after the breakup, OLPC accused Intel of violating written agreements and disparaging the XO laptop in developing countries. Negroponte calculates the market for low-cost educational computers at 1 billion people. Both OLPC and Intel are competing for this market, and Intel has used its vast resources to outsell its competitor. In Argentina alone, Intel will sell 3 million netbooks, while OLPC has sold about 1.5 million across 10 different countries. For FSRN, I'm Marcos Federman in Buenos Aires, Argentina.
And that wraps up today's program. The newscast was produced by Catherine Kopp. Headlines editor was Jess Burns. Washington, D.C. editor was Leanne Caldwell. Today's technical production team at KPFM Berkeley is Rose Katapchi and Scott Pham. You can visit us online at fsrn.org. You can send questions, comments, or news tips to comments at fsrn.org. Thanks for listening. In New York, I'm Dorian Marina.
Winner of the 2010 Premier's Award for Excellence in the Arts, the Guelph Jazz Festival offers more than ever with a Better Than Ever Festival Pass.
Take advantage of all of the festival has to offer, including Chicago Underground Duo and Kid Koala. Guitarist Mark Ribot, last seen in Guelph with John Zorn, returns with an all-star trio featuring the legendary Henry Grimes on bass and Chad Taylor on drums.
This year, the festival pays special tribute to the ECM recording label.
Having recently celebrated its 40th anniversary, the award-winning label has been heralded by UK newspaper The Independent as the most important imprint in the world for jazz and new music.
Several ECM artists will appear in concert, including German-based cellist Anya Lechner and Argentinian bandoneon wizard Dino Saluzzi.
The festival takes place the weekend following Labor Day, from September 8th to the 12th.
Festival tickets for individual shows as well as reduced festival passes are on sale now. Visit www.guelphjazzfestival.com for more information.
The following is brought to you by Echo Weekly. Weed. Weed is a touchy word, but for the people who publish Echo Weekly, we recognize that this is an issue of debate. What does marijuana represent? Does it represent something that's going to harm society by making us fall away from our basic responsibilities? Or is it just a way to have fun? Echo Weekly, free every Thursday.
Come to the Guelph Food Bank Gigantic Indoor Garage Sales. Last sales of the season. For toys, Small furniture, fabrics, books, textbooks, picture frames, small appliances, lighting, clothing, and more at great prices. Our 12 weeks of garage sales pay for 12 months of our heat and hydro so that we can provide much-needed service to the Guelph community. There is also a barbecue and silent auction. The Guelph Food Bank Gigantic Garage Sales happens rain or shine, 100 Crimea Street, from 8 a.m. to 6 p.m. on September 10th and 11th, and September 18th, our last sale of the year. The Guelph Food Bank is not government or United Way funded. We operate with the support of local individuals, businesses, schools, and service organizations. We've been serving the Guelph community since 1989. Stay tuned for garage sales in coming months.
I'm Amy Goodman, host of Democracy Now!, your daily grassroots global unembedded international independent news hour. Tune in Mondays through Fridays, 11 to noon, here on CFRU 93.3 FM. From Pacifica, this is Democracy Now!
They would have us borrow $700 billion over the next 10 years to give a tax cut of about $100,000 each to folks who are already millionaires.
As President Obama fights to cut the Bush tax cuts for the wealthy, we'll speak with Pulitzer Prize-winning investigative journalist David K. Johnston. Then will the CIA's extraordinary rendition program ever have its day in court? A federal appeals court dismisses a lawsuit against the CIA's so-called torture flights. Then using computer chips to track students, privacy advocates are raising concerns about the use of tiny radio devices to help monitor preschool children. We'll host a debate. And the Justice Department announces it will not bring charges against a Philadelphia public school that monitored students by remotely activating the cameras on their laptops. All that and more coming up. Welcome to Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, The War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman. President Obama's fired the opening salvo in a battle with Republicans over the future of tax cuts for the wealthy. Speaking Wednesday in Ohio, Obama called for allowing the Bush-era tax cuts for the wealthiest Americans to expire at the end of the year.
We should not hold middle-class tax cuts hostage any longer. We are ready this week, if they want, to give tax cuts to every American making $250,000 or less. That's 98-97% of Americans. Now, for any income over this amount, the tax rates would just go back to what they were under President Clinton. This isn't to punish folks who are better off. God bless them. It's because we can't afford the $700 billion price tag.
We'll have more on this story after headlines. The oil giant BP has released the results of a four-month internal probe of the April 20th explosion that caused the worst offshore oil spill in U.S. history. While admitting partial fault, BP appeared to put more blame on the other companies and contractors that worked on the Macondo well. The report could be a preview of BP's legal strategy should it face criminal charges. Heavy blame is laid on Transocean, the operator of the rig. The report also absolves BP's well-designed, saying it played no role in the spill. The report doesn't fault any BP officials by name or recommend any punitive action. At least 10 alleged militants have been killed in a pair of U.S. missile strikes in the Pakistani region of North Waziristan. It was at least the sixth U.S. attack inside Pakistan in less than a week. New details have emerged in the case against 12 U.S. soldiers over the killings of unarmed civilians in Afghanistan. Five of the soldiers are accused of killing three Afghan men for sport and then collecting their fingers as trophies. Seven other soldiers are charged with covering up the killings and assaulting a new recruit who helped bring them to light. The Afghans were killed after the soldiers allegedly decided to form a, quote, kill team to carry out deadly attacks. In other news from Afghanistan, The Washington Post is reporting Afghan President Hamid Karzai intends to limit the international role in investigating alleged corruption in his government. Karzai has backed new proposals that would bar U.S. and other foreign officials from direct involvement in two anti-corruption task forces within Afghanistan's Interior Ministry. In Mexico, the mayor of a town in the northern Mexico state of San Luis Potosi has been killed in an armed attack. Alexander Lopez Garcia was shot dead Wednesday after gunmen stormed his office. He's the third Mexican mayor to be slain in less than a month.